I'm Peter Gilchrist, and I'm a food writer.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton, and I am a food historian.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We're going to be talking to historians, producers, and some all-round great Scots to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're jumping into an era that redefined the very notion of Scottish food.
Kicking off with a focus on a very special time of year.
It's a very Victorian Scottish Christmas. So one of the things when I'm thinking about how Christmas has been represented, and I think especially around TV and film, I think about Muppet's Christmas Carol.
The best Dickens adaptation, by
Christmas,
the way.
Yeah. And better than Dickens.
That's me with my Victorianist historian Dr. Middleton hat on.
Yeah.
Muppet's Christmas Carol is the best
amazing.
One.
Anything with Beaker.
Yes.
I'm there. And I think about the Downton Abbeys. I think about the Christmas specials, All Creatures Great and Small. But I have never thought about nor seen what it was like to live in a croft in Scotland at Christmas.
Yes.
And maybe we should start this off by describing or answering the question, exactly what is a croft?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So, I mean, I'll answer your question.
My
mental image of a croft, a Scottish croft, is a sort of low house, probably with one room. Depending on where you were, it might have a thatched or a sort of woven roof.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very thick walls and rural. That's, I think, the critical element.
Yeah.
You're in the countryside somewhere, you're far away. It's kind of more, this is not Christmas Carol. This is slightly more bleak, potentially.
Yeah.
You know, a very different, a harder way of living, a way of life that was typically more working class. It was people who were working the land.
Mm-hmm.
That's what comes to my mind when I think croft.
Yeah. And I mean, and a croft really is two things.
Mm.
Croft means essentially a small holding.
Yep.
That you rent and you farm it.
From a sort of tenant landlord.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. And the other meaning is that often on a croft was a small, as you say, one room, perhaps two room.
The actual house.
Cottage.
Yeah.
A small, one level, everyone's in there. If you're doing well a wee bit later on, you might have windows, glass windows.
Yep, maybe.
You'll have a creaky wooden door.
Mm-hmm.
And you will live there. You will rent this land. You might pay for that land. Your rent might be part of what you grow, part of what you rear.
Mm-hmm.
Your rent might be in exchange for services. So you might rent the land and you look after animals or you harvest.
You farm other parts of the land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can keep some for yourself. Or, like a traditional farmer, you have that land, you grow, you rear, you sell, you pay.
Yeah. So what you might also have had as part of a croft was a kale yard. You know, part of where you were feeding yourself, probably, rather than, say, you were harvesting crops for your landlord or for yourself to sell. A kale yard was more of a personal domestic space.
Yeah. What we would call today a kitchen garden.
A kitchen garden, exactly. And of course, the name comes from kale, you know, that you would typically be growing hardy vegetables in these spaces because even today, the climate in Scotland is not great. Historically, even less so.
Mm.
So things like kale, neeps, hardy vegetables. You might also keep a couple of animals in your kale yard that would be potentially separate from the ones that you were farming for someone else. So chickens. You might have a couple of sheep or a goat, a cow maybe. And cows were very useful to have because you would then, it wasn't just about the meat, but you could use them for milk and dairy. So cows, goats, sheep, that kind of thing, they would be kicking around in a kale yard. And there were actually kale yards in cities until potentially mid-19th century, but it was far more attached to your sort of croft economy.
Mm. And I think what the overriding emphasis on all of this is that crofting is a way of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you are growing the food you eat and you are working the land to pay for that land or to sell, to make money, to buy things. You are relying on weather. you're reliant on community. Often crofters, they would buy a piece of land, or sorry, rent a piece of land next to their family where they grew up with. They would get married, they would build a croft, build it from the ground up.
Yeah.
And that was the way of life. You lived in communities. And when we think about things like clans, I think we can get really carried away with battlefields. And
or like tartans. Big sieges and castles.
But clans really revolves around communities living together where you would live next to your parents and your children would live next to you, and communities evolved and grew together and looked after one another. And I'm sure part of that was about military, but far more what that was focused on was survival together, that safety in numbers, looking after each other. Mm. And you really see that around Yule and Christmas.
So what's interesting, I think, about crofts as a space, if we're talking about the Victorian period of the 19th century, is that because of that way of life, traditions almost hold on longer in crofting spaces, in these rural communities. We do, as we mentioned in the last episode, have a massive movement of the population away from these kinds of rural life, these small holdings, the ability to farm things for yourself, harvest the food yourself. Enclosure in the mid 19th century means that the right to land doesn't stay the same. So previously you could forage things, you could catch birds and fish, and it wasn't thought of as poaching. There weren't rules around that, whereas that changes in the 19th century. But people who remained in these spaces, who were still working crofts, working the land, I wouldn't want to suggest that life is a slower pace or anything like that, but I think traditions that have been rooted in time for longer, they stay in these spaces longer. And I think, again, Christmas is a really interesting place to analyze that.
And I think the important thing about that for me is that traditions last for longer because they're necessary for survival.
Exactly.
Celebrating quarter days was about understanding how seasons change and how long you had to ration food for, when milk's going to come in from your house cow, when you can start having butter and cheese and adding fat back into your diet after a really lean winter. If you had a sickly child, you were counting down until you could start adding fat back into your diet.
Yeah.
These are incredibly important things.
Mm.
And so when people are moving away from a crofting lifestyle, whether it's through clearances, whether it's through famine, whether it's through having to find new opportunities,
just job opportunities,
they're leaving a time and a place where they are fixed on living with nature, communing with nature, being reliant on nature to keep them alive, and moving to a city where they're relying on people, strangers, people they don't know, people whose faces will change all the time, whoever's behind the counter is giving them food, giving them a doctor that's giving them medicine, and there's a lot of trust you need to put in everyone.
Yeah.
You're also much more vulnerable for the unscrupulous of the Victorian era.
Yes, and I'm sure we will touch upon some of those delights in potentially the later episode about Christmas in the city. But no, I think it is really interesting. So let's imagine that we're in the croft.
Mm.
I mean, I am imagining rain lashing the windows, and I don't know why my mind always goes to the bleak. I think it can be easy to have a romanticized idea of Scotland in the past, especially Scotland in the Highlands and Islands in the past. It would have been really hard.
I mean, I live in a tenement that's poorly insulated.
Yeah, me too. So
I understand what lashing rain, and when you have a door that's not fully sealed, what
the drafts.
Screaming wind sounds like sometimes. And I don't think about it as bleak. I think about it as like the sound of life.
Oh, really. I mean, I love it. Like, don't get me wrong. Oh. Like that kind of atmospheric.
A bit of drama.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is our life now without a bit of drama?
I know.
But also, you've got to think about if you're living on land on a small holding that has animals, you will constantly hear those animals.
Yes.
If you've got sheep,
sometimes they would be in the croft with you, depending on things.
Exactly. Especially cows.
Mm.
We've got the earliest kind of records we have around kind of black houses, which is a particular type of, I won't say a particular type of croft, it's a particular type of house that we have, especially kind of in places like Lewis,
the
Ireland,
Outer Hebrides,
where we have records that show cows living in the house. The reason for that is they're pretty warm.
They are warm. How close have you ever got to a cow?
I'd say I got pretty close to a cow.
I mean, I'm a born and raised country girl, and like used to kind of always befriend the cows that would be in the field next to my mum and dad's house. They're so warm.
Yeah.
And if you're in a freezing house with like one fire, thick walls, yes, but this is cold, like we can't imagine. And
the odd cow pat in your living room is a small price to pay for central heating.
A massive warm cow.
Yeah.
Like when my cat sits on my lap in the winter, I'm like, oh, this is great. Imagine it. I mean, a cow's not going to be sitting on your knee, but still be warm.
But actually, and what everything revolves around in a croft, really, there's no kitchen.
Nope.
But there is a hearth.
Mm.
There's a fire. And in the Victorian era, the most popular was a gable end, which essentially means that it's at the one end of your croft.
Yeah.
And you have a hearth. And around there, you would have your three-toed pots, your kind of like slightly witchy, what's it called again? What do witches throw things into?
A cauldron.
Thank you very much. Cauldron. You would have things called a girdle.
You might have a gridiron.
I will clarify for everyone when I'm talking about a girdle.
Not a corset.
not a slimming garment. It was essentially a Scottish word for griddle.
Yes, a griddle, yeah. And you might have a bannock turner, a bannock toaster, which was a sort of similar thing, but especially for cooking those kind of unleavened oat cakes called bannocks, which are a very traditional Scottish food.
And so you might have, the man of the house might have a chair.
Mm-hmm.
If you've had a good year and you can sell some of your crops, you might get another chair for mum to sit on. And she'll spin yarn, she will knit socks. This is the hub of life.
It's the hearth is the heart of the home.
Isn't it just?
Which sounds like a live, laugh, love sign that you hang above your hearth.
Our Scottish Food History Podcast merch will be coming out soon. The wall decals. Home is where the hearth is.
Home is where the, God, that's what we should have called the whole thing.
can we start again? But no, and I think some of the creativity happens around the hearth as well.
Mm.
So we have a thing called the Rista. In Shetland, it's called the Rista, where it's a space above the hearth where you can smoke fish. In Shetland, they have Rista mutton. I ordered some from Shetland last year.
How was it?
Good. Really salty.
Okay.
As you would expect.
Yeah.
But again, it's kind of methods of preserving food. You might also hang up your yarns if you've been spinning. It's a place where they'll dry. Again, if you've got a really cold and damp environment, you might have a dirt floor, compacted dirt floor. You need to have somewhere where things are going to dry. And you're using that space above the hearth.
Well, I once visited a really amazing sort of museum on one of the Inner Hebridean Islands of Ulva. In fact, it wasn't a black house, but it was a sort of croft. And they'd sort of kept it as traditional as possible. And actually, one of the things they had was almost what I imagine a Yule log was like we touched on in the previous episode. And as a way of keeping this cottage warm, it was basically a whole tree stuck in the gable end fire. Mm-hmm. And the idea was you would sort of put the end in and it would burn very slowly. And as you were doing so, you would like hang things on it to dry. So it was like a drying rack, a tree, probably somewhere to sit. It was your fuel. So you have this amazing, like, I mean, this was not a festive thing. This was just here's a big dry tree. Let's make it last for ages and make it part of the furniture. It was amazing.
Do you think that's like the 19th century version of I need to let the pot steep?
Yeah.
Can you chop the wood? I'm going to bring in the entire tree. I've got this idea. There's some neurodiverse crofter. It's like, I've got this idea. We're going to bring in the entire tree and we're just going to edge it slowly into the fire
that
over
is
6 months.
Exactly the kind of thing I can imagine one of my wee brothers like saying to try and get out the job of chopping the woods. Yeah.
I've got this brilliant idea. And then one person found it 200 years later. And like, this is how people used to live on
history,
the Inner Hebrides.
History, yeah, exactly.
So one of the kind of most important texts, not just for Christmas food, but understanding working class life, crofter life, rural Scotland life, is Florence Marion McNeill's The Scots Kitchen.
Is this the first time her name has come up in our podcast?
Can't be.
I think it might be, and I'm shocked, because what a woman.
What?
I mean, we could have done a whole series about her, and maybe we will.
I think we will.
We will. We probably will.
I'm going to do a bit. At the moment, I'm working on my Victorian food series.
Yeah.
Which this kind of neatly slips into.
Yeah.
And one of the categories I'm looking at is influential Victorian foodies.
Mm.
So there are people of industry.
Yes.
Tunnocks.
Yes.
Your Robertson's Marmalade, your Brown and Poulsen.
Mm.
But there's also people like Florence Marion effing McNeil, who, I mean, we'll give you a very quick rundown.
Yeah.
She was born in Orkney.
Yep.
In the late 19th century, late 1800s. Mm-hmm. She studied at Glasgow University. Mm-hmm. She was a suffragist. Thank you very much. And she was a political organizer. She was a volunteer nurse.
Did she not start the SNP party, or she was?
So essentially two parties amalgamated to create the Scottish Nationalist Party, mm-hmm. And her brother Duncan were co-founders. And she served as the SNP's first vice president for several years.
Yeah.
She also wrote really important reports about protecting young women.
Yep.
She was very involved in the abolitionist movement. Mm-hmm. She is the most influential, not woman, most influential person in Scottish culture history.
Yep.
And you have never heard her name.
I mean, I have heard her name.
You have heard her name.
But no, I completely agree with you. I think she should be, you know, on the banknotes. And like, we should have...
If I see one more grey statue for some plonker with a factory before I see Florence Marion effing McNeil.
We love Florence Marion McNeil. We do.
But anyway, she wrote The Scots Kitchen.
She wrote The Scots Kitchen. And also, just to point out, she wrote fiction as well. She was a very accomplished, varied writer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a woman of immense industry and talent. Yeah.
And after the success of The Scots Kitchen, mm-hmm. which everyone's granny will have had a copy of this in a shelf, go into a charity shop and look at the Scottish food section or the recipe section.
I bought mine in a charity shop.
And if not, on eBay, you will find a copy. Now, she also, after that, the success of that book, she went on to write a bunch of other books.
Yeah.
Seminal texts on the history of Halloween and Halloween customs. Mm-hmm. She went on to write books, a series of books called The Silver Bough, where she wrote them, I believe, over kind of 8 or 9 years, detailing both regional customs, regional rituals, the calendar of the year. Mm. She was the principal researcher for the Scots Dictionary, and part of her job was to travel and research to preserve words.
Yes.
And as part of that, she went around the country taking stories, taking names, and there are things that we know today, recipes we have today, understandings of our historic culture, because she wrote them down.
Yeah.
Can we get a round of applause for Florence Marion effing McNeil? So, in The Scots Kitchen, so I started this point about 15 minutes ago.
Sorry.
She writes about Yule food, about Christmas food.
Mm.
And essentially what she's saying is you take the food that you eat throughout the year and you add butter, cream, or cheese.
Yep.
I mean, not much has changed.
No. And to that, I would add more meat. You know,
absolutely.
You know, meat is one of these things when you have the Yule version of a food, particularly the kind of food that you would be eating in a croft, the addition of beef broth where you would have used water or, as you say, milk or cream, just something to make it a little bit special.
Yeah. So what are some of the things people would eat at Yule at Christmas in a croft, Lindsay?
So as with many things in Scottish food history, oats were a mainstay. And I think it's interesting how we've mentioned Yule bread recently, which was a sort of special Christmas kind of bannock that would have been made of oatmeal, cooked on your hearth in your gable end of your croft, on your bannock turner if you had one, or if not, sometimes people just used hot stones.
And I think actually, because a lot of people don't know what a bannock is, can you explain to us what is a bannock, Lindsay?
So a bannock is a very traditional kind of unleavened bread, and it is, or bread or oat cake. There are different kinds of bannock, and there can be regional differences in bannock. So for example, a Selkirk bannock, which you can still buy today, is almost like a kind of fruit cake. But a bannock, as when I say bannock, what I mean is a sort of flat oat cake made from oatmeal, water, maybe some milk, that you would basically, you could cook it over a hearth.
Mm-hmm.
You could cook it over an open flame. And the key thing here was this was a kind of bread or a sort of staple carbohydrate that people could bake over fire when they didn't have an oven. because that was very, you know, it would have been uncommon unless you were quite wealthy to have an oven until ranges became more the norm as the 19th century progressed. But if you were in your croft and you had your hearth, you would have a flat stone or a bannock turner or a griddle, and that's what you would put your bannock on and you would turn it. And it not an oat cake as we would maybe think today in terms of like a flat cracker. Instead, they are sort of thicker, heartier, almost like a kind of savory, flapjacky oat cake thing. You would eat it either on its own. If you had things to add to it, you could have it with, I don't know, honey. I mean, I've seen people eating bannocks with crowdie, which was a sort of Scottish soft cheese that you would make from milk if you had a cow or a goat. But yeah, the bannocks are very much a staple of particularly the Scottish working classes. And that is true for hundreds of years. You know, people are eating bannocks right from, you know, early days right through the entirety of the 19th century.
And if you're wondering, why aren't people just eating bread? There's a really simple answer for that.
The weather.
The weather.
The weather.
And actually as well, the soil. When you're thinking about Scotland, you've got to imagine the central belt, lots of the south of Scotland is essentially filled with clay pits.
Yeah.
It is governed over by rain, hail, wind. Wheat doesn't love that. They love long, sunny seasons to mature and when they start growing in overly damp soil or waterlogged soil, they rot.
It rots, exactly. And I mean, that's the lowlands. The Highlands was even worse. There's less soil to deal with before you're on the rock bed.
But like, Highlands is essentially just jutting rocks out of the ground.
Exactly. So oats are a hardy crop.
Yeah.
Oats, things like rye as well. Rye was quite a hardy crop. Mm-hmm. And also peas and beans. So peas meal would have been used as a flour. You would grind up beans and use that. So rather than our kind of white traditional fluffy bread that we would think of now, these would be quite coarse breads. They wouldn't really have much rise to them. Mm-hmm. Some parts of lowland Scotland, you could grow wheat. And certainly, you know, the wealthy had an appetite for things like white bread because it was a status thing involved. And in the Victorian period, you actually find all these horrible accounts of bread being adulterated with things like chalk or
Plaster of Paris.
These awful things that millers would add to flour to bulk it up so they could sell more, or that bread would stay white.
Yeah.
And yeah, you really don't want to be eating that.
And if you remember, when we think about the beginning of this episode and we're talking about what is a croft, you can grow oats.
Exactly.
Or bear meal.
Yeah.
Or some of these grains, you can grow them in your kale yard, right alongside your brassicas, your kales and your cabbage and things like that. And then if you have an at-home mill, or if you have a mill that maybe the local abbey owns, or if you're a landowner might have a mill, and you would take your oats to them and get your oatmeal thing you can begin to make porridge with, and the husks that we go on to make sowins.
We'll
come back to that.
Yes.
Or let's go on to it now.
Yeah, let's go on to sowins now, because I feel like, I mean, again, I've got my food historian hat on always. I know what a bannock is, but sowins was one of these things that was like, oh, that's kind of new to me. And I think what's interesting about sowins is we quite often get caught up in these fads of food and things go in cycles. So when lockdown and the pandemic happened, I got very into making sourdough bread.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, this is fun. I can have a starter.
I got into making a starter.
Not the bread.
I got into feeding this thing and then forgetting about it for 3 days and losing all hope.
Did you give it a name?
No, that was obviously...
See, that was
my mistake.
For people who want to know, my starter was called Alexis Sawyer Dough. And Alexis Sawyer is one of my favourite Victorian chefs, who we're not going to talk about because he didn't really have much to do with Scotland, but look him up. Great guy. So, anyway, I got quite into making sourdough, and that fermentation process was really interesting. I think people got quite into it. It's like kombucha, these sort of modern, almost, they seem like fads, but actually there's a massively long-standing history of fermented foods. And sowins is kind of the Scottish equivalent. And what you would do with sowins is you would take the outer husk of an oat after it had been milled, and you would steep it in water and liquid, and you would just leave it alone. And then it would begin to ferment, and what you would end up with, so you would have a jar, your Samhain's jar, and there's a recipe for this in F. Marion McNeill's book. And
not a very specific recipe, if I remember rightly. No,
there's a lot of guesswork going on. Yeah. But what you would end up with in an ideal world, all going well, was a sort of two separate liquids. On the top would be a kind of clear, funky liquid that some people apparently drank.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine it would be overly delicious.
The other thing that you do with the water on top is you create perhaps the most unfortunate named Scottish recipe, sourpoos.
I was going to talk about sourpoos.
So that's...
So you
sorry,
go.
I'm stepping. We're both reading from exactly the same book. So we're going to have some of the same references. But sourpoos...
Upsetting name.
Yes.
Really upsetting.
I don't... I've never made them.
I don't know if I ever will.
I want to, because actually, this is one of those really
bringing
interesting things.
Bringing them to a
things.
Party, like, oh, hi, I'm Peter, and I brought the
about sourpoos. Hello, my name's Peter, and I'm a food historian, I brought some sourpoos. But it's a really interesting idea that Scotland as a whole is not engaging in wheaten bread.
Yes.
Massive generalisation, of course, there are pockets.
Yeah.
And we don't have that kind of making a starter culture.
No.
Where we're going to have a starter, make bread from it, feed it.
Mm.
That's represented a lot in English history.
Yeah.
Because of the availability of wheat.
Yeah.
And the importance of bread in sustaining a peasant diet.
Mm.
But this is an example of where you're using the byproduct of creating sourpoos,
mm-hmm.
creates a stable culture of bacteria, like a starter, that you then add to an oat mixture to create a leavened bread.
Yes, so you go from your bannock, which is your unleavened oat cake, you use your, again, oat product from the husks of the oat, you put that back into your oatmeal, and you get leavened bread. It's like a whole beautiful oat cycle.
I love that. And so what is the bottom part of sourpoos then?
So the bottom part becomes this sort of creamy, basically, I mean, I'm not going to put my hand on my chest and say I know all the science behind it, but basically the bottom part is like the starchiness that comes out of that, of the oats. And it becomes a sort of creamy, opaque, white liquid. And that is sourpoos. And what you would do with that is you could just, again, have it as it was, or you could bake it or like cook it in a pot. And it was almost like a kind of porridge. It was like porridge, like meta porridge. Like, yeah.
Meta porridge.
I don't know, like porridge once removed. Like,
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's
yeah,
like
yeah.
there's process.
The first cousin of porridge.
Yeah, they famously got married. But interestingly, sourpoos in Scotland, I mean, it was something that you could have because oats were just there. But it is actually in certain parts of Scotland, particularly tied to Christmas. So in places like the northeast in Aberdeenshire, back when Christmas Eve was the 5th of January, because we were still celebrating on the 6th rather than the 25th of December, it was called Samhainsnicht rather than Christmas Eve. And that was because the whole process was tied around coming together and eating a big pot of sourpoos. And this is very much something that you would do. You could have your three-toed pot full of sourpoos on the hearth. You would eat it collectively. And then Samhain's morning was Christmas morning. So it's amazing that, like, in some parts of the country, the name of Christmas gets displaced by the name of this, like, funky porridge.
But again, it goes back to showing how central food is. Is sourpoos a drink? A non-Newtonian fluid? Is it?
I think it's whatever you want
it to be.
And I think one of the things I read, which was quite interesting, was because of the quite viscous texture of sourpoos, it was good for suspending things.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I love, not just about Christmas, but other Scottish traditional holidays, is the divination aspect.
Mm.
And it was always tied to romance.
Yeah.
Like, this was, Samhain's was like the Christmas dating app of this period. And what you would do is you would have this pot that you would be gathered around with your family, with the people in your local community, you know, young adults in particular, be like, oh, we're going to have some fun around the sourpoos pot tonight. And something would be, so you could put a ring in it and this would be suspended. And if you happen to be served the part of the sourpoos that had the ring, it had really, you know, really good news for your marriage prospects that year.
I mean, yeah. Obviously just a randy bunch.
I'm clearly going wrong. Like, I need to start cooking sounds, putting loads of
by yourself,
in, by myself,
17 rings. Oh. Am I going to find one?
Am I going to find love?
Is it for me?
But yes, so your Yule sounds would just be sort of have that extra air of celebration about it.
It would have cream.
Cream rather than
butter.
Yes, you could sometimes put treacle on it.
Mm.
Sugar, something to elevate it, make it a bit more special. And it's the same with like Yule Brose. So Brose is yet another liquidy oat-based dish.
Yeah.
And it's basically sort of, and there are lots of different kinds of Brose, but at its basic form, it is kind of almost just like a porridge. But instead of making it with water and oats, a Yule Brose, I've seen recipes for Yule Brose that make it with beef stock. So it's like, ooh, this has a wee...
Maybe something extra.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you, and again, this is, we're trying to provide context for what life is like.
Mm.
You're eating from your kale yard.
Yes.
You are eating porridge, you're eating oats, you're eating that every single day.
So imagine how magical it must have been when your brose was made with stock instead of water. Mm. That genuinely must have been transformative.
You would have thought about that all year round.
You would have. And same with things like... I found a reference to a special kind of cheese that was made. I can't remember what the name
Yule
was.
Kebbuck.
Yes, Yule Kebbuck. And that was sort of kept from earlier in the year, particularly for this time of year when, as we've touched upon, fat was in quite low supply.
Yeah.
So to keep a cheese.
Yeah. I sat down with Ian Mellis, the founder of Mellis Cheese last year, and we had a... maybe 4-hour discussion about cheese, which I think is a perfectly adequate time to talk about cheese.
Absolutely.
And his take on it was that Kebbuck is really like a colloquial name that can mean any kind of cheese that's made. It's every village,
has
every
its
wife
own.
Might have its own Kebbuck.
Amazing.
And the majority of cheese in Scotland, if you've got a house cow, because you'll go out in the morning, you'll milk the cow. You'll then take off the top to create butter because it can last a lot longer.
Yes.
And then what's left is skimmed milk and you turn that into cheese. So it's skimmed milk cheese. It's a lot harder than the cheese that we're used to.
Yeah.
He said it was something closer to like a Wensleydale.
Interesting.
Where it's perhaps slightly more acidic and actually would have been a very like difficult cut. It doesn't have the fat in it that keeps it soft. Not like a cheddar.
No, exactly.
Cheddar doesn't come in until we see kind of cheese coming from Dunlop in Ayrshire. So actually, if a cheese was going to be special, someone's Yule Kebbuck might be that they make cheese with fat.
Yeah.
Or if they're keeping cheese, they're going to be keeping that cheese for that day. And it's about that, saving it for something special, because if you can only have the cheese, the butter, the special foods, the beef, you're going to save up, you're going to have it for one night. You want it to be a celebration.
Yeah. So, beyond your sowins and your brose and your kebbuck, what else might you be eating in a croft at Christmas?
Well, if your croft is near the seaside, then there's a gift you might give.
Okay.
And you'll have haddock up to here with these gifts. It's called the Yule Couple. Now, this is a smoked haddock.
I'm picturing like a Finn and Haddie type idea.
I think the closest thing that we have to it is an Arbroath Smoky.
An Arbroath Smoky, okay.
And this is just a hypothesis because the Yule Couple was two yellow smoked fish.
Yeah.
And an Arbroath Smoky traditionally comes as a pair.
Yes.
And it's most popular in the Northeast, as is an Arbroath Smoky. And I think if you're wanting to think about when you're bringing this along to a party, a smoked fish doesn't have to be cooked.
No, it doesn't.
So you could eat that at the party. You could pass it around. If you're thinking about creating a charcuterie board, a Victorian croft or charcuterie board, I'm into that idea.
Yeah.
Some Wensleydale, some oatcake bannocks, some surpoos. and a Yule Couple.
Excellent. Yeah. Delicious.
But again, it's a gift. And we see food being given as gifts throughout the winter period. It's sowing. You might in Shetland, you might give someone sparrels, which is a kind of an air dried salted beef sausage.
What's interesting with both that and your Yule couple.
Yeah.
It's preserved food. Yeah. So you're right. I mean, it might have been eaten at the time.
Yeah.
But more likely it's going to be taken into the pantry, and it's you're kind of doing this neighborly restocking of everyone's. You're sharing what resource you have so that all these foods are kind of moving around in the community. Everyone is sharing what they have. Everyone's getting something. Everyone's giving something away. And I love the fact that like preservation is such an integral part of this because we are in the depths of winter here.
And in the last episode, you mentioned the Yule Mart.
Mm.
And that's another thing where the Yule Mart is essentially beef or ox that everyone tries to have at Christmas.
Yes.
And I think about it as a kind of early human right in Scotland that everyone had to have their Yule Mart. They had to have a salted beef. And if someone in your community didn't have their Yule Mart, you would cut off a bit of your own.
Yeah.
You would make sure that everyone had that meal to celebrate.
Mm.
Because, again, when a year is filled with relative proximity to starvation, having a day where you can, everyone can feast, everyone can be full.
Yeah.
It can get you through those winter months. You have the memories. We all have food memories that, that brighten up our day. But in a year that's filled with relative feasting, where we have more options, food is cheaper, you know, on a grand scale, historically, we have access to more food than we've ever had before.
Yeah.
Having a day where you have something a little extra special is really important.
Mm. So we are delighted to be joined by one of the most aptly named food historians in the business, Dr. Neil Buttery, who is a wonderful food historian. He's written many amazing things and books about various food historical topics, including Before Mrs. Beaton, a book about the wonderful Elizabeth Raffold, A Dark History of Sugar, Need to Know, and most recently, The Philosophy of Puddings, which will kind of come into what we're speaking about today. But Neil also runs the British Food History Podcast, which I believe is currently on its 8th season, which is incredible. So we're thrilled to be joined by you, Neil. Thank you so much for coming along.
Thank you very much. That podcast keeps getting commissioned. I don't know who it is who keeps recommissioning it, but I'm very grateful.
Well, absolutely. And our listeners should go and have a read because it's really amazing.
Hold on. People commission podcasts. What are we doing here?
I'm the commissioner.
Is that right?
Yeah.
We've commissioned this podcast.
Right. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. This was commissioned by ourselves. Yeah. So, Neil, we are getting things kicked off and I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
I have a thought that I think people that are in love with food today were given responsibility for food when they were children. I remember it was things like Angel Delight and then jelly. They were sort of child-friendly tasks in the kitchen that I was left alone to get on with.
Mix-abouts.
Yes. Mm. Do you have any memories of that yourself? And perhaps, is there one related to Christmas? Was there a Christmas task that you were given with food or something more general?
Well, speaking more generally, this definitely happened at Christmas time too. So my mum was a good old, and still is, a good old-fashioned cook and baker. So, you know, making most baked things from scratch. There was a lot of pastry in our family. She was good at pastry. So when I was very young, and I'm assuming, it's hard to know when these things were happening because you're young and you can't really remember, but I'm assuming it's kind of rainy school holiday days.
Yeah.
She'd be making apple pies or whatever.
Mm.
And I would have trimmings to make little jam pasties out of,
or
make little jam tarts and that kind of thing. And of course, when it was Christmas time, the mince pies. Mm. And I distinctly remember cutting out the circles for the top of the mince pies and then taking a little star shaped cutter to cut out a little star. And then you had two tops for two mince pies, you know, one with the round bit and the star missing, and then this little one with the star on, which
was very really economical.
Cool. That's so clever.
Zero waste cooking.
Hey, Yorkshire family.
Yeah. Sorry, I have no context for what that means. Are Yorkshire families very economical?
They are very organic. You could say tight-fisted people.
People say that about
that
Scotland as well.
Yeah.
I think that's just everyone other than the South.
Yeah. Northern, exactly. These northern climes.
Yeah. Yorkshire's northern, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, right. Not totes. Not for us. Like anything like north of Durham is the north and anything, you know.
Yeah.
But no.
It's all relative.
Isn't it just? You've just written The Philosophy of Puddings.
And yes.
Obviously, we're focused on this podcast and this series about looking at Scotland's Christmas past. So yeah. Is there a crossover between The Philosophy of Puddings and Scottish food history?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Clootie dumpling.
Right. Mm.
I would say, and tell him if I'm wrong in this, there's a spectrum of puddings, mm-hmm. oaty, meaty.
Yeah.
This is happening also in England because there's an equivalent to the early Clootie dumplings, which had, yeah, fruit and spices, maybe a bit of sugar or treacle, but oats mm-hmm. rather than wheat, at least the original sort of versions of them. And he had also over the border, hacking pudding, which as far as I can see is exactly the same.
Interesting. Right.
What is so, hacking?
Hacking, yeah, H-A-C-K-I-N. Oh. Eaten at Christmas.
Okay.
Maybe, or through the Christmas period. Boiled, first of all in a paunch, but eventually in a cloth like Clootie dumpling is. Mm-hmm. So I think the, of course, I mean, we like to divide countries up and people up and centuries up into these nice, neat nuggets because the real world isn't like that. And of course, over the border, and I mean, the border, Scotland moves up and down. Mm. Anyway,
every 2 weeks moves a mile.
All over the place, isn't it, for quite a few centuries. So obviously there's going to be cross-contamination of different food cultures and a sort of chromatography effect as things get moved out. And you get these residues that lay out and are the same. So I would say Clootie dumpling, hacking pudding are probably the same. And then you get divergence because I think you get the Clootie dumpling gets sweeter and sweeter. You get things like treacle, which can be black treacle or golden syrup, right? Yeah. I guess it depends. It's all movable feces, whatever you fancy, what you've got in.
Yeah.
I really like a Clootie dumpling.
I love Clootie dumpling. Yeah.
And I really like the really old plum pudding recipes and the plum duff recipes, which are much plainer. Mm. A modern day Christmas pudding is too much.
Mm. Quite.
It is too much. You have one spoon and you're done. And I don't know about you, but on Christmas Day, I want to be able to go back for thirds.
Yes.
I don't want to go one spoon, that's me done. That's ruined Christmas as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I've got a bombshell for you here, Neil.
Go on.
Often, Lindsay's family don't even have a Christmas pudding.
Do you have a Clootie dumpling?
No.
No.
We don't make it to dessert because we've had so much of the main courses. We will have a Christmas pudding. It will be in the cupboard, but it does often get eaten in July. Because
fair enough.
Yeah.
Hey, they were used to be eaten all year round.
Exactly.
You're just being more historical. That's what you could say about that.
I'm authentic.
Being true. I'm being true to my roots, Gilchrist. Thank you. Gosh.
So for our listeners who might not know, Neil, could you describe what a Clootie dumpling is?
Well, there's various different versions. Like I say, it's a bit of a movable feast. The original recipes, as far as I can see, are oatmeal mixed with some flour. Mm-hmm. And I guess the proportions of those two are going to change depending upon what decade or century you're in and the home economics.
Exactly. How wealthy your residence is.
Yeah. Because, of course, flour is more expensive than oats. Mm. Obviously, suet. Because a boiled pudding ain't a boiled pudding unless it's got some nice beef suet crumbled into it, as far as I'm concerned.
Ain't no pudding like a boiled suet pudding.
Sugar. So it could just be white sugar, brown sugar, or better, because you get a better consistency, I think, some kind of treacle, so black treacle or golden syrup. Mm.
An invert sugar,
indeed, yes.
I know things.
Whatever dried fruits you can afford, so currants again being the cheapest, but maybe raisins as well. Mm-hmm. If you could be bothered to pick the seeds out, or if you had staff to pick the seeds out.
Or a young child.
More likely. Or a young
tiny,
child.
Tiny hands.
Tiny hands.
Yeah, but they're going to eat half of them though, aren't they? Just a tiny child.
There's a story in the British Newspaper Archive of a mum who's stoning raisins and a child who thought that the stones were the important part and so was just eating every time she puts one down, he leaves the stone and eats the flesh. And then she goes, what are you doing? She goes, I was just eating the skin.
Oh, no.
Of the... I don't want to imagine what beating that Victorian child.
Yeah, you're
cruising
for a bruising there, I think. Jeez, oh. Yeah.
What else? Yeah, so spices and, well, recipes that I've seen, and yeah, you might have to correct me on this one because I might be wrong here. I mean, I use milk, but I've seen recipes that say buttermilk.
I mean, the answer
again depends what you've got in.
Exactly. What you've got in. And it depends on where you're looking. So if you are someone who lives rurally and you have a house cow, you will milk the cow in the morning and then you'll most likely skim it and make butter. And if you have a surplus and you're perhaps not making bannocks or you've got a surplus of buttermilk, then you might use that.
Yeah.
Or you'll be using the rest of the skimmed milk, whatever isn't going to be used for skim milk cheese.
Mm. But I think it's something a little bit tart, a bit sour. Well, it acts as a flavour enhancer.
Mm. Yeah.
But, you know, a little bit of acidity can kind of cut through the richness again, which means you can eat more of it again.
Yes.
You know, I think, you know, puddings are fillers. You know, even when puddings were expensive to make, they were still fillers. Mm. And there's something very satisfying about that.
I mean, plum pudding, Christmas pudding, are they interchangeable?
And what exactly, for our listeners, is a plum and a Christmas pudding?
What is a plum?
What is a plum in the context of a plum pudding?
Hmm. Good question. Right. I have seen... only one recipe for plum pudding that lists plums, and by that it means prunes, dried plums,
right,
for starters. However, this comes with a caveat, because the word plum was also a byword for sort of any dried stone fruit.
Okay. Yeah,
so you get plum cakes, which we would call a fruit cake today. So that's quite confusing. So you sometimes think, well, is it plums that are on that list of ingredients, or is it just some fruits, stone fruits? It's really hard to uncover. So that's the first sort of wishy-washy answer I'm going to give to you.
Perfect. We deal, our currency is folklore. So yeah. Just if you start it with people believe, then you can say anything you want to.
I'm going to steal them.
It has been said that. Scotland's ancient people believed that. Yeah, perfect. Mm.
Well, it's they're much plainer though. Like I was saying before, they're really plain. There's much more flour. There's most of the sweetness is coming from the fruit. When you make an old recipe, you're surprised at how little sugar there is and how few spices there are.
Yeah,
but I think, again, much better for it. They're typically boiled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they seem to have a bit... So I can't find any examples of any kind of Christmassy looking plum puddings that are made in Guts.
No.
I can't find anything like that.
I'm quite glad you can't, to be honest.
I think rice puddings come from Guts, and so does bread and butter pudding. Wasn't expecting those.
Yeah, rice pudding, that...
Something about the image of rice pudding coming out of a gut is really unappetizing.
I think I'm over this now. I'm done with it history. Right.
Done.
Well...
it seems to have its origins in the pudding cloth.
Yes.
Yes.
I can be pretty sure about that, I think. You could say there was antecedents in pottages, but it's all too hazy and difficult to pin down. So yes, plum puddings may or may not have had plums, but they certainly had lots of dried fruit in there. Plum duff was a very plain version. You see references to that sometimes, and that was eaten all year round. It's not eaten at the end of the meal. It's usually eaten during the first or second course, and it's paired with meat.
Right.
And the classic one in England, and then when there was the Union 1707 and the British Empire, I guess it became the British national dish.
Yeah.
Though it was the English national dish, really, which happens quite a lot. We English do like to use the word British when really what we mean is English. But anyway.
Yep.
We won't get into that. We won't go down that rabbit hole.
No, let's go down it. I think if ever there was a podcast for a talk about national divide, I think it's here.
It is true, isn't it, though? A lot of English people do get it mixed up. But anyway, yeah, it's the pairing of roast beef and plum pudding.
Plum pudding, yeah.
You do see, I saw recently boiled turkey and plum pudding.
Oh, interesting.
But so whatever meat and plum pudding, you see hunting puddings quite a lot, and they're just basically plum puddings that are designed to be eaten with, you know, pheasant or partridges or whatever. So well, it's sweet, but it's not dessert. Dessert was for really, really sweet stuff.
Yeah.
Syrups and, you know, exotic fruits and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, we have puddings as part of breakfast as well. You know, black pudding, white pudding.
But also, my memories of clotted dumplings are sliced for...
From the butchers. You could buy it from the butchers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never had clotted dumpling for dessert in my life. I've only ever had it at breakfast.
Oh, I'm really craving clotted dumpling there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose once you start adding things like, you know, you maybe take the oats out, you know, that nice nuttiness. Mm. You know, it's getting definitely moving away from haggis.
And more towards fruitcake.
Yeah, you're putting treacle in. Yeah, it's more of a boiled fruitcake, yeah.
We're going to pull another Christmas cracker.
Yes.
Another Victorian Christmas cracker.
Yeah.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, let's go. And a joke.
A Victorian joke.
A Victorian joke. Ready?
Yeah.
Mrs. Henry Peck, whose mother has been visiting them for over 4 months. My God, can you imagine? No offence, Mum. I don't know what to buy Mother for a Christmas present. Do you?
What do I get her for Christmas?
What do you, Mr. Henry Peck, get my mother, who's been visiting us for over 4 months, for Christmas?
I don't know. What do we get her?
Yes, buy her a travelling bag. That's actually quite good.
It's quite good, but I wouldn't say it's a roaring laughter. But maybe in the Victorian era, around a Victorian dinner, that would have been...
You just have to hope that dear old mother is not sitting at the end of the table, which she probably was.
Which she probably was. Yeah. And you're going, that's a terrible joke. I want you to stay for as long as possible.
You know what my mum says about guests?
What?
They're like fish. Any longer than 3 days and they start to go bad.
Okay.
So, if you're ever visiting my mother... 3.5 days you're pushing it.
Yeah.
Okay. This
the Victorianism.
The Victorianism of the day. And I don't actually know what this one means.
Okay.
What is, Peter, a mutton shunter?
What do you think a mutton shunter, if you had to guess what a mutton shunter is?
So we know what mutton is, a sort of older sheep than lamb that was very popular in the Victorian era and before to eat.
If I told you this was a job, a colloquialism for someone in society that has a job.
Is this like me being from Aberdeenshire and being told I'm a sheep shagger?
No. No, Lindsay, it's not.
Okay.
A mutton shunter is a policeman.
A policeman? That's even worse. Oh, no. Why?
I don't know. I actually didn't research the etymology. It was just a mutton shunter.
Mutton shunter. Oh, that's funny. It feels
offensive. If I find out the etymology, I'll add it in after here in a recording.
It feels offensive. It does. But I like it.
Right.
I'm going to start using that as an insult.
Okay. Join us next week for a look at Christmas in a bustling Scottish Victorian city with our episode Christmas Comes to Town. This podcast was hosted by Peter Gilchrist and Dr. Lindsay Middleton. The sound engineer was Curtis Campbell at Studio 23. This episode was produced by Tenement Kitchen. To find out more information, please email hello@tenementkitchen.com. Also, Victorian sex workers were known as mutton on account of dressing down their age. Policemen were constantly clearing them away off the streets or shunting them. Hence, policemen became known as mutton shunters. You're welcome.